You are listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. Thank you for downloading and subscribing. Coming to you virtually live from high atop the historic Raleigh building in beautiful downtown Raleigh. The NCF&B takes the listener behind the scenes to tell the stories of the people that contribute to the creation of the food and beverage community of North Carolina. And now, the misfits in the dish pit, the faces of the front. They are Max Trujillo and Matthew Weiss.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss. And today we are, in fact, in studio. But just imagine, if you will, put on the, not the Wayback Machine, but the and take yourself up on a journey to Seneca Lake in the Finger Lakes of New York. It's cold there now. It's crisp. It's mountain air almost, and the mist coming off the lakes. And to guide us through that experience is the riveting lady of Red Tail Ridge Winery, another consecutive, although this might not come out consecutive, James Beard nominee for Beverage Professional in the United States, Ms. Nancy Ireland.
Thanks, guys. Nice to be here.
Show's over now. Great.
Okay. That's great. There's nothing to talk about. Thank you for bringing us up to the Finger Lakes in beautiful Seneca Lake.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure to be here where it's so nice and warm. I snuck out right in the middle of a blizzard, so this is feeling quite balmy right now.
But like, for you, of course.
It's like spring.
It's like spring.
Right.
Well, I want to know straight off the rip, how did your business get affected by being nominated, if at all, from being nominated by the James Beard Awards?
Yeah, well, I'd like to say first that we were completely blown away by the nomination because it's someone else who we don't even know nominated us. It's that kind of a process.
Oh, wow.
That's cool.
And, you know, when I found out that we were nominated, I was actually, it was told to me by our local newspaper reporter who covers food and wine for the region, and she emailed me to ask me for a quote. And she said, how does it feel? Do you have any moments or anything to say about being nominated for this James Beard Award? And my response was, what? And she printed that. So, but as far as its influence on the winery, I'd say, you know, I think we're looking at the influence on the region.
Yeah.
I don't think per se that it's really made a huge impact on us individually, but our hope is that it's actually creating a lot more recognition and a lot more interest in the region as a whole because, you know, we function as a community there. So, and, you know, we're not the only people who are really focusing on the food and beverage industry and kind of raising the awareness about the industry and you know, trying to improve the standard of living there for everyone.
Yeah.
So I think it really has had a positive impact in that way. And although we didn't make it out of the semi-finalist list, which in itself we felt was a huge honor.
Absolutely.
We're pretty confident that we won't be the last.
Yeah.
So.
No, and I think as we were talking earlier, as you've mentioned, it's a great win for the region, and one of the reasons that I really wanted you to have you on this podcast is because you guys are almost on a similar trajectory as North Carolina is, and just the fact that there's the synchronicity of you seeing us as an important enough market to come here in the middle of December and visit us and you know, introduce people, although it's already got a good footprint in the market, Red Tail Ridge, is important. And what I mean also by the trajectory is in about 2005, which was ironically when we were talking about when the Pop the Cap happened and this beer movement just went off the radar for North Carolina, This investment in the Finger Lakes happened. And then not only did you move there in 2005 from California looking for a place to make great world-class wine, but in consecutive years, you've had titans of our industry such as Paul Hobbs, Johannes Selbach, Louis Barrault of Chateau de Combe go there. So there's something brewing there. So give us a little insight into why it is such a burgeoning region.
Yeah, well, it's we have our little rough edges, but I think that's what makes us really charming. And back when my husband and I started looking for our own project, because I was in the California industry, went to school at UC Davis, viticulture enology, got my PhD there with Dr. Carol Meredith, who has her own vineyard now.
In the Finger Lakes?
No, in
UC Davis area.
On Mount Veeder, actually, in Napa. Yeah, nice. So she retired and started her own vineyard and winery after being a professor.
And that's a fascinating university, by the way. And for those that don't know, like, that's kind of the Harvard of wine school, to like oversimplify. But that's where you want to go.
Well, it was really compelling for me. I mean, it's a huge campus, and there's a lot of different types of agricultural science that occur there, and everyone is working side by side. So it's a great place for people to bounce ideas off of each other and really learn from each other in different disciplines. And I think that, it's also a great place for grapes and wine as well. And it's probably one of the older wine regions in the country, but Finger Lakes is also very old and has been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
In fact, pre-Prohibition, they were growing grapes and making wine there. And there's a very strong academic campus there as well, Cornell, which has got a long-standing viticulture and enology. They have their own department that's been in existence for a really long time.
Just to jump in and relate it to North Carolina, Surrey College in the eastern or the western part of North Carolina is kind of our Yadkin Valley, our wine region. There is a wine school there I recently visited, and it's beautiful and up-to-date. And the gentleman that runs it actually was from the Cornell Wine School, Wine University there, and came down and just – it's fascinating. So anybody local that is interested in the wine – they're not a sponsor or anything, but I endorse it because it's really cool. That's a really great place to go. You can get, like – I think you could just do a summer class or a semester, but you can really learn a lot about wine school. And it's like – it's nationally recognized. It's a pretty awesome school there.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised to know that there are actually grape and wine education institutions like all over the country now. There are a lot of horticultural departments at small colleges now that are focused on growing grapes. And there's a lot of enology studies now in the food science departments at small colleges. So it's really, there's a lot of winemaking or beverage creation that's happening in almost every state now. So it's nice to see that local kind of artisan beverage and food emphasis that we're seeing now domestically.
Yeah, that is true. But you are rather accomplished in that. So you were saying you have your PhD and you come from a truly scientific background of figuring out the genetics of grape, et cetera.
Yeah. No, my PhD is in grape physiology and grape genetics. And in the mid-90s, so I've been doing this for about 30 years now. In the mid-90s, when I graduated, I was hired directly out of school to initiate a quality program for what I like to call a little family winery in Modesto, California called E&J Gallo Winery.
Gallo. I never heard of them.
Yeah.
Gallo Winery. Yeah, they've been around.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. They've been around. Yeah. They're still family-owned, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I was hired right around the same time that they had made major investments in Gallo of Sonoma. And I was a part of their real focus to raise quality standards within the company across all their beverage portfolio, working both on the vineyard side and also on the winemaking side. And I was with them for 12 years, and it was a...
Quickly rose the ranks to vice president of research and development.
Yeah, I'm looking back at it, I'm surprised that all that happened in 12 years. Because, a lot of things, the culture just really started to change dramatically at Gallo. And when I left, it was actually, my own department, which I had created, was 50% women. And it wasn't really focused on hiring based on gender. It was really on capability and on expertise.
The way it's supposed to be, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
So the greatest thing about prefacing this, the rest of your story, by telling the Gallo thing is you did a complete 180. Not only did you go from California to New York, but you went from arguably the most corporate of wine environments to
literally the largest producer of wine in North America, I believe.
In the world.
In the world, okay.
Well, you know, it's been 14 years, so I'm not quite sure. But the last time I checked,
yeah.
But they're still privately held, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
To then go to, as Matt was saying.
Yeah.
To create your own mom and pop winery in the Finger Lakes.
Yeah, so, you know, when I went to school for viticulture and enology, it was really kind of with this focus for agriculture and farming. Quite frankly. Hmm. And over time at Gallo, you know, when you do a good job, they keep assigning more things to you and they keep promoting you. And before you know it, you're not really growing grapes and making wine anymore or touching the process. You're really managing people, really good people, but you're also going to meetings. And you know that it's starting to get a little crazy when you're going to meetings to prepare for meetings. And it just got crazy because we had projects in the Southern Hemisphere and all over the world, and I was traveling a lot, and I really didn't see my husband very much. And we just got to a point where we actually had to make a date at a hotel or an airport restaurant in order to see each other, because I was flying in from an international flight and he was flying somewhere domestically, and we wouldn't see each other unless we did that.
That's kind of romantic, though. That's pretty cool.
Well, and you know you like the guy because you went through customs twice then.
Yeah.
If you had to go meet him when he was flying domestically.
Wow.
Yeah
Felicia would be like, we'll FaceTime.
Yeah. Do you want to maybe bring your passport? I don't know.
Yeah,
I like Felicia put on a post last night, hanging out with my favorite person, well, sometimes, in the world. I'm like, really? You had to qualify? Well, sometimes.
Well, you know, I'm glad we brought up the wives here because it's an interesting segment, Nancy. We were talking earlier about how we know each other, and your wines were with Martin Scott at one time in New York, and I used to represent Wilson Daniels in New York. And so we were sitting outside of a meeting, and we started chatting, and I'll get to the point about my wife. So I was telling you that, oh, I'm going to France, and I think you had just gotten back. And you probably don't remember this conversation, but I was like, yeah, but I'd have this little stretch here where I don't really know what we're going to do, and I think we're going to be around Carcassonne and blah, blah, blah. It's somewhere in the West where they make great cassoulet. And you said, oh, they have this thing where you can rent a houseboat and take it across France. You should do that. And I was like, that sounds amazing. That sounds awesome. Yes. So I rented this houseboat to go across the Canal du Midi. Mind you, this was in between staying at Chêne Bleu, which is this unbelievable chateau in Vaucluse, where they literally, when you get out, because we represented them, they literally, we were met by Rémy, the butler. Like, I will take your bags, you have a private chef, and it's literally, I mean, it's just, and then after that, this was the bookends, we stayed at this unbelievable chateau in Bordeaux on the right bank, but let's just say that my wife was not that pleased, because the Canal du Midi houseboats were very rustic. So thank you for thank you for getting me in trouble with my wife, Nancy.
I was a long way around to say that Sarah was not pleased.
She was not pleased by that. But it was a great idea, I thought.
Actually, let's take a quick break to talk about our brand new sponsor. It's our title sponsor of the podcast. This segment is brought to you by our brand new sponsor, the Folks Foundation. They are champions of all good things crafted in North Carolina and the folks that make them. And they are a journal. It's an online and printed journal with fascinating articles. You can actually read an article about our podcast. That's how we were connected. The folks at Folk Foundation travel all over the state in exploration of great crafters, makers of art and music and podcasts, perhaps, and also food and beverage products. Truth be told, the way we knew them is that by driving around all over our state, they listened to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast and thought, wow, we really like those guys. We should partner up with them. And we started looking through all of what they do, and they really are a great extension of what we do and what our mission is. And so for you, as a listener, you can sign up and become a member of the Folks Foundation. As a member, you are directly supporting makers, growers, crafters, and artisans of North Carolina from the mountains to the sea. And when you support, you are benefiting handcrafted culture in our state that directly affects our lives every single day, from local products that we eat to the music and podcast production we listen to every day. But membership packages vary, but they all at least include a subscription to the Folks Journal and access to exclusive content. So visit them at folksfoundation.org or check the link on our show notes in the podcast. That's the Folks Foundation.
Awesome. So getting back to other fantastic folks, let's get back to your story in the Finger Lakes for a second. The other thing about the Finger Lakes, and that I didn't mention earlier, besides all the newcomers, is you've had quite the history, as you mentioned, with Dr. Constantine Frank going there and Herman Weimer. So it had been there. And I'm also wondering, what do those wineries think about all this newness in the Finger Lakes?
Yeah, well, I think it can be easily said by the famous quote, you know, a rising tide floats all boats.
We say that often on this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, we're always trying to figure out ways to raise the exposure of the region as a group and to, you know, really express to people, you know, all of the most interesting things that are happening there. It's like a real food and wine revolution right now. You know, we moved there 14 years ago primarily because we wanted to get back to, you know, the whole reason why I went to school in the first place.
Yeah.
And that was to get back to touching the process from the very beginning all the way through to the end. So at that time, 14 years ago, we looked all over the place domestically to find where we could start our own project. And really, financially, we wanted to do it with our own dime. Mm. We really didn't want to bring in a bunch of big investors and have to have any more arguments and discussions about money. You know, we just keep it between us and keep it simple. And we looked at a number of states back then. And, you know, given that we did a lot of work with sustainability when I was in California, I was always looking for the longevity of a community to become a part of. And really, we looked at places like Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Idaho. Obviously, West Coast was financially out of our reach because we wanted a decent piece of property, size property. I knew about the Finger Lakes because I had projects with Cornell and with the USDA, which is in the Finger Lakes. And I'd been going back to check on these projects and touring around the region, and I could see people were figuring out how to grow Vitis vinifera and what to grow and how to make the wine. And it was just such an opportunity, you know? I mean, very rough around the edges, but you could just feel the energy, and you could see the history there, which is what you were getting to. I mean, people had been in the region. There were multi-generational families growing grapes and now involved in the wine process, and everyone had a passion to kind of raise the level of awareness and to raise the quality standard of the region. And it was someplace that we could get in on the ground floor and really be a part of that energy and to help to kind of be a part of shaping the future of that region. And, you know, here we are 14 years later, and man, it's amazing. Every time I turn around, there's something new happening there. You know, there's just so much going on. And it's not just about wine. It's about the community as a whole. You know, we have chefs moving to the region, chef owners, new restaurants. Just in the past couple of years in my small town at the top of Lake Seneca, 3 new hotels.
Wow.
The Airbnb communities really exploded. A lot of people are taking their summer cabins and they're retrofitting them into rentals. And I mean, there's just so much. Plus, there's the, you know, there's the distilleries and the breweries and the cideries and over 150 wineries now.
Sounds like a hipster's paradise.
It's pretty awesome, if I do say so myself. Yeah. I am a bit biased, though.
Yeah. Matt, did you ever spend time in the Finger Lakes growing up?
Not growing up. I went back there. I was dating a girl whose family was from there, and so we went there for a little while. But I didn't really, at that point, get to visit the wineries. And only when I was working in New York did we start to hear about the Finger Lakes as a real... I mean, of course, you learn about Constantine Frank because, you know, that's the history of really growing Vitis vinifera in this country. I mean, they're arguably, but in very cool climates and extreme weather. And so only then did I start to get a taste of the Finger Lakes.
Yeah, so as a layman to this region, how would you, in a real simple term, kind of relate the Finger Lakes to, say, like a wine-growing region, or what should we know about it as a region?
Sure. So that's a really good question. And that's also one of the driving factors for why Michael and I felt compelled to move there, because domestically, there's really no wine region like it. The soils are glacial-formed, which from a winemaking perspective makes it super interesting, because the depth and the carving of the glaciers is highly random. So what comes up and the depth of the soil itself is random. You can have two vineyards right next to each other, and the soils will be completely different.
Oh, wow.
And you're not even including the alluvial deposits that come from the glacial movement. So there's a lot of variation in the soil. But as far as the climate is concerned, it's a very much a cool climate.
Yeah.
I mean, I worked in California, and I know there are a lot of higher altitude places in California that refer to themselves as cool climates. Like, yeah, no.
I want to think that it's like, would I be wrong in saying that maybe Germany or Alsace would
yes.
be more like similar? Is that, would
yes.
that be kind of right?
So it's a cool climate, so we have to have varieties. We need to focus, and we're embracing this now, which I'm really happy to see. We need to embrace varieties that are able to get to full ripeness in a shorter growing season with less degree day heat. So you'll see varietals were very similar to Epernay in many ways.
Okay.
There are a lot of people, and quite frankly, our history in the Finger Lakes is really core of that is sparkling.
Yeah.
If you look really a long time ago, we had a lot of French families in the region making sparkling wine. Traditional method, Veuve Clicquot, Roederer, the Fournier family was doing a project with Taylor.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, that's the stylistically, that's really what the heart of our style is.
You know, Max,
can we try this?
I wasn't going to share this with you, but I feel compelled now.
Because
oh. Nancy was so kind enough. The first thing I did when I saw her this morning, she said, this is for you. And she gave me a, here you go. Go ahead.
Okay, so careful now. You need to burp it. It's a pet net. Just give it a little burp because it could be a little warm.
Do I tap it like a
no,
baby?
No, no, no. Don't tap it, but it's a little warm.
Here, I'm
so
the one with
go
the 7 months old,
go slow.
So I should be burping it.
Yeah. Go slow, yeah.
So and the first thing she hands me is this pet.
Oh, God, it's everywhere!
We've talked about this before, but a Petillant Naturel, so naturally fermenting in the bottle.
Also known as Method Ancestral.
Yes, thank you.
So it's the way French peasants used to make wine.
You
yeah.
cannot see this because it is a podcast, but it is beautiful. It is this bright red, crimson, purplish red, I guess, in tight little bubbles. It's frothy. But it's a beautiful looking wine. So the varietal composition of this
Pinot.
It's just Pinot.
Yeah.
Oh wow. Okay.
Pet net for breakfast. This is breakfast of champion, y'all.
Yeah, that's
right. Sounds right.
Yeah, that's
beautiful.
Right.
Thank you.
A day without bubbles is like a day without sunshine.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's right. Now, and for those of you that listen to this and like, oh, Nancy's fascinating. I want to learn more about her. There's a great article in Forbes about you and your husband in Redtail Ridge. And one of the things you said is really the history of sparkling wine in this region. So it really, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about it and the up and comings of it. And when you talk about it and you think about the connection with Champagne and how horrible the weather is in Champagne comparably,
yeah.
it makes so much sense. And the fact that you grow Pinot Noir there too.
This is baller. I don't think that's a wine term, but I've been at the game a little while. No, this is fantastic. You still get a tannin, you still get acid structure, but it's got that yummy factor as well. It's like a layman, a simple person could, a simple palate, I should say. A simple palate would totally love this,
yeah.
but a sophisticated palate could just dive deep into it.
So Michael and I are really committed to sparkling, and we feel like that's really the direction we should go. And so it's a very long-term endeavor, though, and it's very expensive because you have to put wine away in tirage. So we're focused on traditional method, which for us is going to be like a grower style sparkling. So we're putting things away for 4+ years of tirage, and then we're doing very refined dosage treatments. So brut nature or extra brut, and just looking for that lean, precise quality that you want to see in a very good quality sparkling. But, you know, who can wait for sparkling?
Yeah.
So while we're waiting for traditional method, we make pet net. Is something we can drink every day, and we can drink it immediately after we make it.
You know, and this has taken on a craze also for hipsters. You know, I know that's like a term that's controversial, but for people who like what's new, but also people who just love wine, because as you say, as much as it's new, it's the oldest method of making sparkling wine. So,
yeah.
And by the way, so you also make a Riesling version of this, which we actually have in North Carolina. You can get it in a couple of places. But this, I don't think we're going to get in North Carolina, or will we get some?
You could.
Okay. I'll have to talk to some people.
Yeah. So I've been making PetNet Style since 2012.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because when I started making it, there were very few examples. Like I tried to do – we talked about that. I tried to do some homework so I could like – because I'm a nerd, so yeah. It's like I gotta
you gotta use your PhD,
do some homework before I do stuff. And the only examples I could get were from the Loire Valley. And now, though, if you look, it's like explosive. Everyone's making PetNet now.
What is it? Everybody's just down for bubbles now. Like no matter what, whether it's a Truly,
hallelujah.
But I mean, like sparkling anything. Like if it's LaCroix or a Truly or a White Claw,
right?
Like everyone's drinking sparkling water or beverage in general, which, yeah, is a great thing. I think we should be drinking.
That's great. I mean, for so many years, and this is just a personal opinion, but it's like I've always wondered, why do Americans torture themselves by not drinking sparkling every day? And yeah. I mean, I'm not like a whole – no, not a whole bottle, but just a glass. Mm-hmm. You know, can we just be civilized? Just one little glass, like right before the meal, mm-hmm. you know, just to calm down a bit and socialize a bit and just look at the bubbles.
Yeah. Less Lexapro, more sparkling wine, right?
That would – we'd all be healthier.
Yeah.
Well, allow me to nerd out for a second on this.
Sure.
So the residual sugar in this, do you have an idea?
I got nothing.
Like a guess?
It's less than 20, it's less than 26 grams. That's all I can tell you.
What would you say, Max? Would you say this is perceptibly sweet or maybe would you say fruity? What would you say?
Yeah, no, I think it's fruity, but it definitely doesn't, it's dry to me. Like it doesn't feel sweet.
Yeah, so can I just kind of... This is our Beaujolais Nouveau.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this is a 2019. So up until it was put in the refrigerator a little while ago, like a couple hours ago or something, it was still fermenting.
Oh, wow. Nice.
So this will get drier. As long as it's kept in a warm spot, it'll probably continue to ferment and get drier.
Mm.
But
this is something you want fresh, though, sort of, right? I mean, maybe not age this one.
Well, I still have people sitting on some stuff that, you know, sitting on some PetNet Rosé from a year or so ago. And, you know, they take it out occasionally and it's still showing pretty well. But, yeah, it's meant to be drunk immediately. This is not something I would consider, you know, putting in the cellar as a very age where it's just for drinking. It's just fun. This is not a serious wine. It's just a frivolous, like, fun thing. And my favorite thing to pair with PetNet is bugles.
Bugles,
like
the chips.
My kids put on their fingers.
They screwed up the extrusion on it, and now they're pinched, and you can't put them on your fingers anymore, which is kind of a bummer. So,
well, I know a good place where you can probably not get bugles, but definitely food that would pair really well with all this. This is another brand new sponsor of our show, the Butcher's Market. You've probably seen that around if you're driving around in the Triangle, because they have a few locations in Raleigh, Cary, and in Holly Springs.
Yes, they do.
But the Butcher's Market has just recently come on because, again, they like what we do. We like what they do. Matt eats at the Holly Springs location, what, every other day?
Well, yeah, pretty much. I always get burgers or hot dogs or some of their marinated stuff on my way home because it's super easy to cook. But you know what also I see when I get there, Max, is that everybody is really knowledgeable and their service is really... It's like you're in a fine dining restaurant, meaning it's very attentive. They're really happy to be there. And I think that's the thing, because they are opening up a new location in the Bedford area of Raleigh.
Yeah, like North Raleigh area.
Yeah, off of Falls and News. And they really need some help there with people. So if you want to work for the Butcher's Market, what should you do, Max?
Yeah, well, the Butcher's Market is the modern revival of your neighborhood butcher, offering customers a wide selection of premium beef, poultry, veal, pork, and even exotic meats like kangaroo. They also carry wine, and they have fine cheeses, produce, breads, side dishes, desserts, and other gourmet grocery items to make every meal memorable and delicious. And right now, they are hiring. If you're looking, if you've always been interested in something like butchering, it's an old, like, tried and true skill. It's like that's a cool thing to be a butcher, you know? But if you are interested, experience is not necessary. They are actually happy to teach and train anybody that comes on. They're just looking for good people, because that's really what it's about at the Butcher's Market, is what Matt said, the people. So you can visit the Butcher's Markets, that's an S at the end, thebutchersmarkets.com, and you can inquire within. You can also let them know that the gents over at the NCFMB sent you there, and give them a call. And you can check out our show notes. There's a click on the back of our show notes to link to their page. And now we're back.
So beyond sparkling wines, I did have one more question about the Pet Nat. So the Pinot Noir that you're choosing for this, is it different than the Pinot Noir that you're going to bottle for your estate Pinot Noir?
So we have 3 acres of Pinot, 7 clones, and they all ripen at different rates. But when I choose to target for a sparkling or for a rosé, I always pick early.
Okay. So it's just you pick early.
Yeah.
But it's the same, it's coming from essentially the same areas.
Every year the clones ripen at different rates. So you can't necessarily say it's going to be from the same location in the same part of the block, because depending on the level of clusters they carry the year before, some will slow down in, you know, ripeness the next year. And production the next year, and some will have more. And the more fruit that the vine holds, the longer it takes for it to get fully ripe.
Okay.
So you can't be a lazy winemaker in the Finger Lakes.
No, you have to be pretty nimble.
Yeah, it sounds like it's not, you know, if you're growing Chardonnay and Chablis, no offense to anybody there, you got one grape and it's pretty consistent. They kind of know what they're doing. It's pretty locked in right now. So obviously there's some skill and talent and all that, but it's like, all right, we know what we're doing. Finger Lakes is still trying to figure it out. But what I like is that you're choosing varietals specifically for the region and all that. You hear that, California? You don't have to, just because you can plant any varietal, you don't have to make every grape.
No, but I think it's true. But I think that also leads into the point of the Pinot Noir coming out of the Finger Lakes, where I think probably commercially you're more successful as a Riesling maker, and that's what you're known for.
Yeah, that's our flagship wine.
Yeah.
Especially dry, very precise Riesling.
And we should actually probably pour that estate Riesling in our glass now as we do that. But I do want to say that I have had some absolutely magnificent Pinot Noir out of the Finger Lakes. And for people should know, it's its own style into itself, right? It's not Burgundy. It's not Oregon. It's not Russian River Valley. It's New York State, Finger Lakes region, Pinot Noir. It's going to be super light in color, very earthy, but still a wealth of fruit there. So try it out when you can.
Yeah, I mean, as I was saying about the climate, we're really not like any other domestic wine region. We're much cooler in climate, and we're much more old world in style.
Right.
And so, yeah, we grow varietals similar to the Champagne district, but we also grow Riesling, which is a variety from Germany. And my husband and I are experimenting with Austrian varieties as well.
Yeah.
And also varieties from the Italian Alps area. We're growing Teraldego and Lagrein.
Yeah.
Because the Italian Alps obviously have a cooler winter and more harsh winter season. So, you know, we felt
something similar.
And that's a varietal choice you don't see very often anywhere, to be honest. And so how did you even come to that decision? Like, let's go get some Teraldego.
Well, I have to say that being a researcher at a large winery in California has its perks.
Mm-hmm.
And in the mid-90s, as farmers, we knew that climate was changing. And so the question was, well, maybe we shouldn't be growing these Chardonnay and Riesling in the Central Valley. Maybe we should start looking at varieties that are more suited to hotter, drier climates. So one of the projects we worked on was looking at a lot of unusual varieties for domestic vineyards, but from European vineyards that we felt might do well. And so we put an experimental vineyard in, which actually is quite bigger than my own vineyard that I have now. And we tested a lot of these varieties in a randomized complete block design statistically, you know, and did the wines and replicate and put them through sensory and wine tasting. And I think now you'll see a lot of the varieties blends coming out of Lodi have a lot of these unusual varieties in the background now. Tintacal, Bernarda, Nera d'Avila.
Abigay.
Yeah, yeah. So that's all work that was done in like the mid-90s that has transcended now and is becoming much more part of the commercial face of the West Coast industry. But some of the varieties that I worked with and tasted just didn't work at all.
Yeah.
And just didn't seem right for a really hot, dry climate. But looking at where they were grown historically – and the heritage of these varieties, when we started looking at developing a vineyard in the Finger Lakes, you know, the limestone soils that we have, limestone wash and higher pH soils, and then the cooler climate and the elevated slopes, made sense for that. Mm-hmm. So right from the very beginning when we planted the vineyard, we incorporated some of these varieties. So in our property, we have been growing since 2006, Teraldigo. We've got Lagrine now, planted that in, I think, 2012. And we grow Blaufränkisch, and we've fallen in love with Blaufränkisch, which is Austrian. It's just a beautiful wine for the Finger Lakes. It's, you know, has its Austrian components, mm-hmm. but then it's laced with all these really super interesting Finger Lakes
That's
terroir.
That's the more inky grape, right? Blaufränkisch?
Not really. Not really.
Dornfelder.
Which you also have as well,
Yeah,
right?
We grow Dornfelder, which is a German variety.
That's right.
And this year we planted Schweigelt. But I will say that the lion's share of red that we produce is Pinot.
Yeah.
Because it's so versatile for us. We do Blanc Noir, we do Rosé, we do Rosé Petnat now, and we also do still wine as well.
If I was blind tasting this Riesling, there's no way I wouldn't have thought it was old world, like Austrian or Alsatian or so. It's dry, but it has that
texture,
that petrol on the nose mm-hmm. that you want. It feels old. It feels like old world, but that's so cool. I mean, it's beautiful.
I think it's a really good way for people, because I feel that maybe there's a hint of petrol there, but it's not so present as some German expressions of Riesling that you can have.
Well, it doesn't taste like gasoline. I'm not trying to say that, but it has that
Signature Riesling.
Yeah, signature flavor that you want.
I think of it kind of aromatically like a little waft of petroleum jelly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Incorporated mm-hmm. with some beautiful minerality and some really fresh lime juiciness, especially in the palate. There's beautiful kind of lime juice thickness to the wine.
Yeah.
Nice texture. It's dry, but has good texture. And it has a nice, precise acid spine, which is really what you want for fried chicken or for oysters or for food.
It sounds like perfect for North Carolina.
That's right.
Yeah.
Are we finally ready commercially to drink Riesling and try it from all different regions? I mean, I know as a quote-unquote sweet wine, people drink Riesling, but are we really ready as a wine-drinking nation to drink dry Riesling, dry Riesling?
I got to feel that there's hope, and I'll tell you why. Because not that long ago, rosé was not very popular.
Right. Yeah.
And there was a lot of notion that if it said rosé, it was going to be sweet. And so people avoided it. Now it's, in my mind, it's not a seasonal beverage anymore. It's everyone drinks it all year round, and people have really embraced it. And so I feel like there's a chance for dry Riesling because I feel like it got a bum rap in the 50s and the 60s when we had a huge bulk amount of it hit the market that was sweeter and frankly not a very good quality product.
Mm.
And now we're just like trying to claw our way out of that as an industry and as a, you know, a focus Riesling supplier.
But see, I think that and this goes for anything that's happening in the world now. This is an exciting time of humanity with technology, with social media and the internet and all that, but just communication around. I think the reason why whatever gets a bad rap is because there wasn't a lot of information about anything at the time. And so you'd get one person that maybe didn't like something and they wrote an article in, the New Yorker, and then it's like, oh, well, that's what it is. And we're all going to believe that. Sideways came out and said, we're not drinking any effing Merlot. Yeah. So then Merlot fell off the page. But and then Pinot went nuts because of that movie. And it's like, really, that movie really did impact the wine culture, which was kind of silly if you think about it. But now, because like a podcast like this, or a Forbes article that comes out, or just somebody Instagrammed something about something, I think that we all are just we're learning, and we're always educating ourselves on what we want, and we have access to anything now. So I think that we're ready for rosé, we're ready for sparkling, we're ready for Riesling, and now everybody just kind of knows what they want because they can self-educate.
Yeah, no, it seems like a much newer day, basically.
It's crazy.
I think consumers are much more interested in exploring different types of beverages and much more interested in things that are new or revisiting things that they haven't tried in a long time and giving it a try again. So, yeah, I really do feel strongly that there's hope for Riesling because unlike most white varieties, Riesling can be so many things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a multiple personality grape, and it can be, and it doesn't really even have to do with levels of sweetness. You know, it's actually aromatics and flavor that can be drastically different. You know, yeah. I have 14 acres of Riesling, but I can make multiple styles, very different styles of Riesling every vintage from that one vineyard. So
yeah, we're going to taste in a minute one of your Auslese, so a sweeter version of Riesling from a specific block. But I'm wondering, as now your impression of visiting North Carolina and coming down here, what's your impression of the market and how your wines fit in here?
Well, I've only been coming down here for a couple of years, but it seems just in a couple of years that I've been coming down here, the general public seems a lot more receptive.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that by all age groups, that all people seem to be interested in. I look at Finger Lakes style as not as heavily extracted, lower alcohol, you know, crisper finishes, more balance, more delicate textures. And it seems like people are becoming much more open to that.
Yeah.
I mean, we're tasting the Estate Pinot Noir right now. And I'm looking at the Pinot, and the Pinot is translucent.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
have to say, you know, given my background, quality in Pinot has never been linked with color depth. It's never been about color, how dark the wine is. Pinot is made by aromatics and flavor and texture, fullness in the palate. And that's really what you have to open your mind to and stop thinking about the color depth.
Right.
That may be important for Cab Sauv or Zinfandel or for something else, but for Pinot, it's much more about balance and elegance and, quite frankly, finesse. And I think there's much more receptiveness to that now.
Absolutely. And that's what I was saying earlier. I mean, the color, this is very typical of the region. And it's just, I find it so much more refreshing. And it doesn't mean that it still can't stand up to your meats or your steaks or stuff like that. It's got everything in terms of volume and power that it can. But I do have a question to take you to task. Were you on the committee that came up with Mega Purple then?
You mean Purple 8000?
Yeah.
Purple 8000 is a standard thing that was used in the West Coast. I haven't been there for 14 years, but I mean, it is something that you can buy on the market for winemaking. So,
wait, explain, what is this?
What I'm referring to, Mega Purple, there was so what Nancy was talking about is that people have this perception when you see color in wine, that this is powerful, this is quality.
Right.
And so there were winemakers and very notable wineries that were adding a substance called Mega Purple. I'm sure Nancy can speak to the science, that would give a wine a purplish color.
It's like
color.
Food coloring,
yeah.
Essentially,
yeah.
For wine.
Yeah. I mean, for example, let me give a great example of how unlinked color depth is with quality and flavor and mouthfeel. Dornfelder,
yeah.
Okay, which is a German variety, is black.
Super inky.
Jet black. But the characteristics of the varietal, when it's true to type, is that it's actually very light-bodied. So you have this big color, black texture, or black characteristic of the wine looking at it, percepting it. But then putting your nose in, there's beautiful jam. But then you put it in your mouth, and it's very, very light-bodied. There's hardly any tannic structure, and it's just a very easy-to-drink red. So the two are not linked. You know,
yeah.
You can have a really dark wine, but it's still incredibly light,
yeah.
And short in the mouth.
Yeah. Hmm. Do you find that people up in the Finger Lakes are taking your lead, or are you just adding on to what was already a culture there in terms of really dialing down to what specific varietals are meant for this area?
Well, I think there's no doubt there's a lot of experimentation that's been going on and has gone on for a long time. And, you know, if we go back to the generations that were obviously there before I was, you know, people were growing and have been growing Separavi and Ricchezzatelli.
Mm-hmm.
And those, I think, in my mind, are perfect examples of varietals that should do well in that region as far as winter hardiness is concerned. As far as the winemaking style is concerned, they tend to be pretty aggressive varietals, and so they need to be kind of worked with in the vineyard to make sure when they come in the cellar, they're very well balanced for winemaking. But it's definitely a process that's happening in the Finger Lakes. I mean, there are some really nice Separavis coming out. And
Are those Vitis vinifera, Separavi?
I believe so.
Okay.
And Ricchettatelli is a really beautiful white wine. Sometimes it's done as an orange wine in Europe. And it's been grown for a long time by Dr. Frank. Grown very well.
I was a judge for the North Carolina wine competition out here, and the Ricchettatelli was the number two wine that was grown. It was grown – we actually should speak to the producers coming up soon. They're out there just outside of Charlotte. But the winner – was our boy John Wright over at
Sanctuary Vineyards. Go, baby.
Yeah, in the Outer Banks, so that was cool.
We've been championing them, I mean, for as long as the show's been on, as long as we first tasted the wines.
Their wines are awesome.
Yeah, maybe, Nancy, maybe you can come down and also consult, because I think there's struggle in North Carolina, at least for some, as to what could be a commercially successful grape here.
Well, and that leads me to this question, and so please take this in the spirit that it's intended. It's not meant to offend, but I want to know, how much, as a scientist, how much work is being done in the lab post-harvest, both by yourself, but also just because you've been in the business for a while? Like, I don't think people realize how much, maybe it sounds bad when I say this, but how much manipulation is done post-harvest and post-crush in the lab to make wines taste the way the winemaker wants them to taste.
Are you – well – so I can only speak to
what you do.
What I do.
Sure.
And I've been doing it for 14 years now. And I can tell you that primarily my process for determining ripening is with taste. So I have a very well-developed language for berry sensory analysis for each variety, and it's based on sequential tasting. So you go out into the vineyard, because as a winemaker, that's really where the wine is made. You're out in the vineyard constantly. You're in the vineyard more than you're in the cellar until, you know, harvest is upon you. And so you're going out and you're evaluating what's happening in the vineyard. And once you get through veraison, you start tasting and you're looking for the balance between acid and sugar. You're looking for how ripe the pulp is and how easily it separates from the seeds. You're looking at the lignification and the nuttiness of the seeds themselves, how ripe they are. And with the skins, you're kind of chewing on the skins. It's we call this the very technical spit test, especially for the reds, where you're kind of grinding up the berry and grinding up the skins, looking for that green kind of tacky effect on the inside of your lip. And that would tell you that the tannins are not ripe yet. But also, by grinding the skins, your spit, your saliva, is acting as an extractive substance. And then what you do is you simply spit and look at the color of your spit. And you can trend analysis when you're tasting as that color starts to darken. But sooner or later, you get to a point where you realize you're kind of at your maximum, and you're really not increasing in flavor ripeness. Your Brix may still be going up, right? But your flavor has reached its true potential. And that's the time that you need to start thinking about bringing the fruit in.
Yeah.
So if you are, let's say that the tannins aren't where you want them to be, what's an example of something that you would do in the vineyard to alter that? Like, what would you do?
You can't really. I don't really do
any altering. You wouldn't, I know that, pruning on a certain side, right? So we don't want the eastern sun to hit so hard. So we're gonna keep the leaves on the eastern side of the grape so that it's not burning out in the morning sun or so.
We really don't have, like, it's just kind of a unique environment that we have up there. Sunlight intensity is really not.
Not an issue.
Okay.
It's a cool climate region, and our vineyards are actually on a fairly steep slope. So we're actually looking for as much sunlight exposure as we can to get the ripening that we need. And we also have to deal with disease pressure, because we do occasionally have, you know, bouts of humidity. I don't think it's as intensive as it is in the more southern states up in the Finger Lakes, but we do have our moments up there. Mm-hmm. And so we do an incredible amount of handwork in the vineyard, basically from the very beginning, right after bloom, leaf plucking, and then also cluster thinning while the clusters are very green, arranging canes to make sure we get really good airflow through the area. So for us, it's really reducing the average humidity in the fruit zone, all right, and trying to make sure there's a much as much movement as possible of air through the fruit zone to keep the humidity lower, to reduce the potential problems with humidity and disease incidence.
Yeah, what is humidity like out there? I mean, North Carolina, we're pretty humid, and so I think that's a huge struggle for winemakers in our state. But what's that like up there?
Well, we usually average during, August, it will get humidity in the mid 80s for several days. And that will be, a challenge for us, but we also get the heat. But normally, we're talking anywhere around in the 80s for the summer temperature. And, humidity is somewhere in the 70s, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, just again, because I'm the layman here. So when you were finding a region that you wanted to work in, and is it fair to say that humidity tends to be like a humid region tends to be difficult for winemaking growing, or is that just, or you just grow different types of grapes, or like if you have a humid area, what do you do?
Well, humidity, you'd need to consider your grape varieties, but it's a combination of weather and soil. So you have to also look at the influence of the soils and how vigorous the soils are. Mm-hmm. If you have really vigorous soils and you know you're going to be having to manage that, you probably need to pick rootstocks that are devigorating and choose varieties that are not known to be, heavy crop loaders. And try to manage that whole process. So it's a combination of weather and also the soils and how vigorous the soils are.
So that brings me to a question, because what you're saying and the humidity and the fact that you have lots of lake influence, could or does this Riesling that we're about to taste have any botrytis, noble rot?
Yeah, this is Auslese.
Okay, yeah.
So as a winemaker in the Finger Lakes, like we've talked about, you have to be nimble. Every vintage is very different. We don't have consistent vintages. We're a lot like the old world in that way. We do have a lot of changes every year, and you have to kind of roll with whatever Mother Nature gives you. We had the perfect storm in 2013 in a section of our vineyard for botrytis, which is also known as noble rot. And this Auslese is actually a product of that process.
Okay.
And I basically, if I see noble rot developing, that's really exciting.
Yeah.
Because if you get the kind of quality that you need, you can make it completely one of a kind, very unique wine style. And so in 2013, we had that possibility. For me, the most important thing was to keep track of it and make sure it didn't go off the deep end, so to speak, and go in the wrong direction. And, basically try to keep my husband out of there.
Yeah. So just to simplify what we're talking about, noble rot, so, Max, in any, like the Sauternes of the world or Tokaj, the greatest sweet wines of the world, often see noble rot, meaning the grapes are literally rotting. And what happens is, obviously, you get less juice to grape skin ratio, but the juice becomes very sweet.
Yeah.
High sugar content, and you get this unbelievable sweet wine.
Yeah, it's actually even more complicated than that, because what happens is the botrytis will infect the grape surface and then dig into the grape surface and start sucking the moisture out.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it concentrates everything that's in the grape. So not just the sugar, but also the acidity and some of the flavor compounds, everything gets emphasized.
Yeah.
And not only that, but it's a parasitic interaction. So it's also depositing a little bit of itself into the flavor profile. And so what happens is it's a fine line that you walk, because that can go off, because other pathogens will try to take advantage of that infection. Things like sour rot, which are things you don't want to see in an infection.
You want that good fungus.
You want the good, you want the noble rot. You don't want the sour rot.
For chefs or culinary people out there, huilacoche, the fungus on corn, is kind of almost kind of like the food version of that in a way. It's not easy to come by. It doesn't naturally grow, or it does naturally grow, but you can't kind of predict when it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like finding a truffle in the forest or so. So you get that huilacoche, you want to cook with that. It's very desirable. So the noble rot to a grape is kind of that.
Yeah.
It's a happy accident in a way.
It's an accident, though, that you have to watch constantly.
Yeah.
And you have to keep an eye on the weather, because we do get remnants of hurricanes. So we have to kind of keep an eye on that.
That's
as well.
Right.
But with noble rot, usually what happens is you're looking for complete infection and you're looking for desiccation and high sugar concentration. So you're kind of waiting until the very last minute before you pull the trigger for picking. And picking involves hand selection in the vineyard for concentration. So you're looking for clusters that are 100% affected and shriveled. And then you're bringing them in. In our case, we lay them out on a table, and then we smell each cluster to make sure that it has really good aromatics and there's no potential sour rot in the mix. Mm-hmm. Anything that has an off note gets thrown away and then pressed off in slow fermentation. And these wines are really young. This is a 2013. It was held in bottle for a couple of years before released, and this wine is still coming, still
rocking and rolling, still
moving.
For a long time.
Yeah, I gotta say these wines are fantastic. Like, thank you for bringing these in, Matt. Like Matt was emailing with me, and he's like, "Dude, you know who we have to speak with?" And forgive me, I just didn't know about your winery at the time, and I had seen your name when the James Beard Awards the nominations came out, and I was like, "Okay," and then it clicked, and then it all made sense to me, but. This really makes sense. I mean, I know why you're being nominated for a James Beard Award. Not that that's the end-all, be-all, but, you know, it's a great
point of validation.
Yes, point of validation. Thank you. These wines are fantastic. So being a little transparent right here, Matt, your day job.
Yep.
You work for Winebow, the country vintner. You're going to go out with Nancy and go sell these wines.
Absolutely.
Have you sold any of these wines to Triangle Wine Company?
Of course. And Triangle Wine Company, even if they don't have them in stock right now, you know they'll order anything for you. So Triangle Wine Company, they're a great friend of ours. They will get these wines for you at a moment's notice. We'll have them there the next day for you. So yeah, and you can get them in four different locations at the Triangle Wine Co. You can all get them all the way out in Southern Pines, where Nancy, I believe you were yesterday, in my backyard, Holly Springs, or you can go to Morrisville if you're coming home from RTP or something like that.
Swarp is listening. Swarp, we know you're listening.
Yeah, go to the Morrisville location. And then their flagship in Cary. Also, you know, they have this beautiful tap rooms where you can sit down and have a beer, a glass of wine, a glass of champagne. And you can go online and they'll deliver to you if you can't get out there. And how do you get that, Max?
Go to trianglewineco.com and you can put in the NCFB promo code to receive a discount on anything that you purchase there. So that's a great way to go. I mean, like a great wine shop, you can ask them for something and they can put the order in. They can contact Matt and he puts the digital order in and get what you need. That's a great way to go. And because we are running short on time, I mean, seriously, I can't believe this hour has gone by like that. This has been fascinating. I hope everybody's still listening at this point because everything we've been talking about is tremendous. While you're at Triangle Wine Company, you also can purchase our last sponsor that we'll mention on the show, that's Proof Alcohol Ice Cream. And Nancy, for you, I don't know how it's going to keep on the day, but you guys might have to go eat this as you are driving around. But I don't advise that. That's illegal. Do not do that. But Proof Alcohol Ice Cream is 7% ABV. It does include alcohol, liquor in the ice cream. It is a different way to enjoy your dessert. And so you go to proofalcoholicecream.com. We'll let you pick what ice cream you'd like on your way out of here. Coconut rum, apple pie moonshine. There's a lot to choose
from.
My
favorite is the cheesecake moonshine.
Oh,
personally.
Yeah. Well, Matt.
Well, this has been great. Nancy, thank you for educating us on the Finger Lakes. Congratulations on your James Beard Award.
Thank you. My pleasure. It was a pleasure to be here.
Great. Look for Red Tail Ridge Winery in your local wine shop or your restaurants. You will eat and drink very merrily.
Thanks for listening to the NCFB Podcast. And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.